I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire, National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be having a very serious conversation about U.S. foreign policy, the D.C. blob, one of our favorite subjects on this show, and its long history, and much, much more with the president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Andrew Bacevich, joins us to talk about his new book, After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. In the past year, America has faced a pandemic, protests over racial injustice, and a number of other challenges. And in the future, we'll be facing crises created by climate change. Andrew Bacevich takes a look at all of this in After the Apocalypse and says that in order to deal with the challenges we face here at home in the United States of America, we must look at United States foreign policy and take a new path away from outdated Cold War modes of thinking if we hope to face the challenges ahead. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Let's get right to the conversation with Andrew Bacevich, president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of the new book, After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I'm very excited to be speaking with, someone who I think has been doing really important work on the issues of U.S. foreign policy, I would say following in the footsteps of great thinkers like Gore Vidal, Charles Baird, the late Chalmers Johnson, president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of the new book, After the Apocalypse. Andrew Bacevich, welcome to Parallax Views.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So just to start out, and we didn't discuss this before I hit record, but I wanted to get into it a little bit. I believe you have described yourself as coming from a sort of Catholic conservative background, and I come from a more left-wing background, but it's interesting to me. I think a lot of people have this conception that conservatives are inherently pro-interventionist or inherently pro-war, hard power. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that, you know, conservatives can be very skeptical of the military-industrial complex and things of that nature. Could you speak a little bit to that?
I think that's what you just said is very true. Of course, the same thing can be said about, broadly, the left. I mean, there are people on the left who are principled opponents of war. They may not be out-and-out pacifists, but they're very skeptical about using force to advance the nation's interests or fix the world's problems. There are other people on the left, I think the mainstream of the Democratic Party over the past, 30 years or so, has been strongly interventionist. So On the left, there's a variety of views about force and foreign policy. I think the same thing occurs on the right. That said, I think you were accurately capturing what is a widely held view that conservatives are hawkish. There is some reason to embrace that view, but again, not everybody on the right is a militarist.
If I could, real quick, what I wanted to add to that was, I think the misconception in part comes in because I think a lot of conservatives were very hawkish during the Cold War. But that was because I think communism was viewed as an existential threat by many conservatives. But after the Cold War, I think some conservatives look at things a bit differently. And historically, I'm not sure that outside of the Cold War, conservatives have always been pro-war. That's sort of what
I think you're exactly right. I mean, I would put myself in a sense in that this category. I was a Cold Warrior. You know, I believed in the cause. I think my views with regard to the Cold War evolved over time so that I was less preoccupied with the ideological construct than I was with the great power competition construct. I mean, in other words, by the 1980s, I really didn't think that Soviet-style communism was going to take over the world. I still believed that Soviet military power posed a problem to the United States. That said, once the Cold War ended, I myself rather quickly began to take a different view about the proper role of military power, about what U.S. grand, how in your face U.S. grand strategy needed to be to protect our core interests. And as time went along, I also came to reevaluate what my attitudes had been during the Cold War. Began to frankly have a substantially different understanding of what we did and whether or not what we did at that time made any sense. That's a long-winded way of saying I rethought the Vietnam War.
So it's interesting as well. I think the other conception people have when they hear conservative or libertarian, or even now I hear a lot of people claim that left-wing opponents of the sort of U.S. foreign policy status quo, I hear them smeared a lot as isolationists. Right. And I don't think that either of us are isolationists. I think that a better word for it is a foreign policy of restraint. So maybe you could discuss that a little bit.
Yeah. So this is a case I have made more times than I can count, and I never am able to put the argument over. But the United States of America has never been an isolationist country. Never, never. The United States of America, dating from the founding of the Republic, but dating from the creation of the Anglo-American colonies, we've been engaged in a strategy of expansionism. I mean, how the heck can you explain how 13 brand new, relatively weak states created in 1776 by 1945 have become a republic that stretches from sea to shining sea, is the richest country in the world, and is the most powerful country in the world? The answer to that is not isolationism, it is expansionism. That said, the isolationist smear, because that's what it is tremendously useful in policing a political discourse. When you call somebody an isolationist, what you're really saying is that person's views are not worth listening to. Where does this come from? It comes from the period between roughly 1938 and December 7th, 1941. That's when the term isolationism came into common usage. And that occurred at a time when there was a very intense debate within the United States among Americans about whether or not the United States needed to involve itself in the crisis in Europe that in September of 1939 became a war. And the nation was divided. Very substantial numbers of Americans said, no, that is not our business. We need to stay out. Now, why did they say that? My argument is that they felt that way because just 20 years before, in 1917, the United States had embarked upon a war in Europe against Germany when it was justified in idealistic terms, the promise to spread democracy, promise to end war forever, and ended in accomplishing neither of those declared objectives, while the United States suffered 116,000 dead soldiers. In other words, 1938, 1939, there's lots of Americans with reason who said, why do we want to do that again? It didn't work. We tried it 20 years ago. Now, I would say that those Americans were wrong, that we did have a vital interest in addressing the threat posed by Nazi Germany. But just because they're wrong doesn't mean that they were somehow anti-Semitic or, beyond the bounds of reasonable opinion. But ever since that period, 1938, 1941, whenever there is a debate about whether or not the United States should intervene, use its military power in this situation, that situation, anybody who expresses reticence gets labeled an isolationist, meaning they're not worth listening to. And it has this whole thing is had such a corrupting effect on our discussion of foreign policy, but it seems to be, part of the wallpaper at this point.
So that leads me to that second part that I was bringing up, this issue of, pursuing a foreign policy of restraint. Right. What do we mean by restraint? And what is your vision? And maybe also the vision I think that the Quincy Institute has for restraint and a foreign policy based on that.
So the Quincy Institute is a startup, a think tank located in Washington, D.C. I'm not in Washington. I live in Massachusetts. That is devoted to trying to make the principle of restraint the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy. What does restraint mean? Restraint means to be more cautious than we have been with regard to the use of force. It means to be more creative than we have been in relying on diplomacy to address problems and to deal with our own threats to our own interests. That's what we're about. We know we are a minority opinion in a foreign policy world that remains committed to a policy of primacy, that remains committed to designing U.S. forces as instruments of intervention, that remains committed to maintain a global military presence, that remains committed to the notion that from one year to the next, the Pentagon budget has to keep going up. So we're opposed to that. To emphasize, we are not isolationists. We are absolutely committed to the proposition that the United States has to be engaged in the world. We just think that the methods of engagement that have been employed, particularly since the end of the Cold War, have been self-defeating and costly. I myself don't understand why the fact that we have wasted something on the order of $6 to $7 trillion on our post 9/11 wars, why that is not sort of a central issue in any election simply baffles me. You know, we all proclaim our support for the troops. We all appreciate their service and their sacrifice. But the very little willingness in Washington to take stock of what our post 9/11 policies have actually yielded.
It's interesting, too, because I feel like maybe, and we could talk about this a bit, but do you think that there may be a change slowly arising with how we think about foreign policy in America? Because I think the Quincy Institute, even though it's relatively small right now, it's not going away. And I think it's making some headway, at least. And I do think the American people as a whole are becoming more open about questioning things like these wars in the Middle East. I mean, we hear the term the need to end the forever wars much more often now.
Well, I'm older than you are, so I tend not to be particularly optimistic. But you're right. I think there are signs of change. I think we saw some of that, for example, in the reception that Senator Sanders got, particularly in his most recent run for the presidency, where he was much more forthright, I think, in expressing opposition to, the typical form of U.S. foreign policy. And his message seemed to resonate. We've got a progressive wing, particularly in the House of Representatives, that I think largely shares the views of the Quincy Institute. They're relatively small in number, but by God, they are capturing a lot of media attention. They're also young, which means that they might well be around for a while. So I think in that sense, there is reason to be at least cautiously optimistic that significant changes in our policies could be in the offing. Now, what's the other side? The other side is the military-industrial complex. You know, the fact that our dysfunctional Congress is in hoc to weapons manufacturers and therefore are not willing to seriously scrutinize not simply the Pentagon's budget, but what the hell the Pentagon does and where it does it. There's also the fact that, you know, God knows I was delighted that Donald Trump lost his bid for a second term. But Joe Biden is a very conventional figure. He is part of the foreign policy establishment. When we look at his most recent or his first overseas trip, I read it as somebody who is living in the past and in a sense wants to recreate the past. the visit with Boris Johnson, who is a comic figure, the two of them signing a revised version of the Atlantic Charter of 1941, basically pretending that they were Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. The document itself, utterly vapid. I think tells you something about the world that Joe Biden inhabits with regard to foreign policy. And it's a world that is mired in the past, which is unfortunate.
I always like to mention that I believe it was President Obama's National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes, said that there's a problem in D.C. that he called
the blob.
Yeah, the D.C. foreign policy blob. And I think it dovetails with a lot of your work in the sense that I think your approach to analyzing these matters, you don't look at this as an issue of one president or another president causing all these foreign policy initiatives to keep going forward. It's sort of entrenched within the Beltway. And maybe that's why someone like Donald Trump, who sort of said that he wanted to be more restrained in foreign policy, wasn't able to completely execute that.
Well, I'm not even sure he tried to execute it. He was such an undisciplined person. But I think your point is basically right. Why did somebody utterly unqualified to serve as president? Somebody who, in my judgment, is utterly amoral, unprincipled. How'd this guy become president? Now, how did all these Americans say, yeah, I want him. I don't want Hillary Clinton. I don't care for Hillary Clinton. But God knows that she was qualified to serve as president. Why'd she lose? And I think the answer is a complicated answer, but you put your finger on a part of the answer, and that is that there are a large number of our fellow citizens who've had a bellyful of war, who are simply no longer persuaded by the rhetoric of American global leadership, who are not persuaded that the lessons of the Cold War have continued application 30 years after the Cold War is over. And I think that they cast protest votes. They said, we're not going to put up with this anymore. So we'll elect this clown who at least was mouthing a opposition to stupid wars, even if, again, he really wasn't able to do anything about it.
And something I wanted to add to that was, I think another issue that has come up when talking about Donald Trump and his presidency is there's been a lot of really renewed attacks, especially, I think, in the media and sort of political sectors against this idea of populism. And I really find those attacks kind of disagreeable because I think it's a way of ignoring what more or less could be called elite or technocratic failure. And we've seen examples of technocratic failure before. I think the book A Bright Shining Lie by Neil Sheehan did that very well. Do you think there's an issue of elite failure that goes into the foreign policy failures we faced?
I do. Elite, being part of an elite means never having to say you're sorry. And as someone who is quite critical of U.S. foreign policy, especially since the end of the Cold War, since 1989, I am struck by the unwillingness of people within that blob, who are part of the foreign, struck by their unwillingness really to critically examine the course of U.S. policy, again, over the past 30 years or so. I mean, at the present moment, I mean, it is astonishing how little critical perspective, an effort to view critically the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. They're forgotten before they end. And I think we see this tendency so clearly in the way that the foreign policy conversation of the present moment centers on this notion of revived great power competition, which really, the essence of which is us against the People's Republic of China. And that recognizing a new Cold War as inevitable, I think in many quarters it's viewed as inevitable, should become the foundation of U.S. policy going forward. So we're sort of whitewashing everything that happened in the past 30 years. And we also then thereby have a radically distorted view of what the actual Cold War was all about. The actual Cold War gave us the folly of Vietnam. The actual Cold War gave us a CIA pulling dirty tricks around the world, almost on every occasion, with negative secondary effects. The actual Cold War gave us the military-industrial complex. So the fact that the blob, you know, is demonstrating this reflexive tendency to embrace a new Cold War as if it were strategically wise, I think is actually evidence of the bankruptcy of the establishment.
I was going to mention in that regard, there was a piece I was reading in Foreign Affairs. I believe it came out in February by Robert Kagan called Like It or Not, America is Still a Superpower. And I was just amazed at the unwillingness to consider on his part, maybe we're wrong about how we've approached things. It seems like he was doubling down, sort of saying, well, the American people need to sort of learn their place and they need to accept that we're a superpower now and this is what we have to do. We're going to have a Cold War with China. It's very sad to see people just unwilling to reevaluate.
Right. So Kagan, you know, before 9/11, Kagan was hard over on the need to get rid of Saddam Hussein. That was going to fix problems. After 9/11, Kagan was hard over on the need to go to war against Iraq because getting rid of Saddam Hussein was going to fix our problems. After we invaded Iraq, Kagan was hard over. This is going to make things better. Here we are, all these years later. Saddam is gone. I'm glad Saddam is gone. That part of the world, basically, we've created disorder and turmoil, again, to emphasize, at enormous cost, whether in blood or in treasure. And we still have Robert Kagan in the pages of Foreign Affairs pontificating about the imperative of the United States exercising global leadership. I mean, you can't make it up. And the shamelessness is what disturbs me. But that's the way the blob operates.
So I guess in that regard, how did we really get to this point where this blob is so entrenched in the sort of status quo within the Beltway? And I suppose the way I wanted to tackle that was dealing with maybe the pivots in U.S. foreign policy first after World War II and then second after the Cold War ended.
Well, okay, so the first pivot happens 1946-1947. The war ends in 1945. Americans don't like to admit it, but the biggest contributor, far and away the biggest contributor to victory over Nazi Germany was the Soviet Union, Stalin's Soviet Union. By 1946, the U.S. allied relationship with Stalin has already fallen apart. And we, the establishment in those days, you know, the people around President Truman, quickly reached the conclusion that Stalin is the new Hitler, that the Soviet Union is the new Nazi Germany, and that dealing with the Soviet Union must become the centerpiece of U.S. policy going forward. And I think the key here is to appreciate the extent to which the transference of the status assigned to Nazi Germany, the transference of that status to the Soviet Union. Very little debate between 1946 and 1948 on that point. There was some. Senator Robert Taft, the minority leader, Republican minority leader of the Senate, raised some concerns. Henry Wallace, who had been Roosevelt's last vice president, argued that we need not rush into an adversarial relationship with the Cold War, with the Soviet Union, but they were minority voices, and the people viewed as sources of wisdom very quickly bought into the Cold War, and once they did. You know, I mean, the narrative of the Cold War is very interesting. There's ups and downs. There's crises. There's problems. But the conception of antagonism between the United States and the Soviets, between the West and the East, between democratic capitalism and Marxism-Leninism carries through then to 1989. You have rightly suggested that that's the next turning point. It was. And I think the key thing to take away from our understanding of that second turning point is the way the outcome of the Cold War was interpreted in military terms. You know, the Cold War ended without World War III happening. The Cold War ended when the Soviets basically say, we give up. Many American interpreters of that moment concluded that, I think they're wrong, concluded that the Soviets gave up because they had concluded they could no longer compete with the United States militarily. In other words, the belief was that it was a military victory, even though shots had not been fired. Now that's the fall of 1989. August of 1990, Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. George Herbert Walker Bush puts together a very large, broad coalition and commits the United States to a military campaign to liberate Kuwait. At this point, neither the Chinese nor the Soviets, both of whom have a veto in the Security Council, neither of them exercise that veto. And so we embark upon the Gulf War, more commonly called Operation Desert Storm. Now, this campaign is undertaken when memories of Vietnam are still fresh. So there is considerable anxiety about whether a war against Iraq could end up being another version of Vietnam, protracted, costly, ugly. Those expectations are demolished when the actual campaign unfolds in a matter of a few weeks, results in a fairly decisive victory, and most importantly, very, very, very low U.S. casualties. Put the end of the Cold War together with Operation Desert Storm, and what you have is an apparent demonstration that the United States has achieved a mastery of war itself, that we are militarily supreme. We've not only prevailed ideologically, but we now are militarily in a position where we cannot be challenged. And I think that, again, we're talking about what you call the second turning point. That second turning point to produce the militarization of U.S. policy to an unprecedented extent. What do I mean? I mean that we embark upon a sequence of interventions, bombing campaigns, saber rattling, big wars and small wars that continue down to the present moment, almost none of which yielding anything like the success that was promised.
I just wanted to add to that. I think people often forget just how triumphalist a lot of people were right after the Cold War. I mean, you had Francis Fukuyama saying it was the end of history. And of course, since you mentioned George H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. He said of, I believe, the Persian Gulf War in 1991, that it was about more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order. And I know people now use the term New World Order in this weird conspiratorial way, but really what he was talking about was this idea of U.S. global hegemony.
Correct, which of course he would never use that term, but I think you have put your finger on the essence of what that phrase signified. And I have no doubt that George Herbert Walker Bush believed that U.S. global hegemony would be benign. He believed that everybody else is going to go along with it. I mean, what would be the point in opposing the United States of America at the very acme of its strength? You know, we were economically powerful. militarily powerful, ideologically powerful. So, you know, the expectation of this permanent global hegemony was beyond folly. But if you put yourself in the mindset of people at the time, it seemed quite reasonable. I mean, and I think one of the key points here is that this was not a wacko idea by one party as opposed to the other one. This is an idea that was widely embraced. If you could look at the language that Bill Clinton, running for the presidency, back in what, 1992, if I'm remembering correctly, this governor from Arkansas of exceedingly limited foreign policy experience, nonetheless issuing these pronouncements about the implications of the Cold War ending, and asserting this global leadership role that, you know, he said, elect me president, and I'm the guy who's gonna fulfill this. So it was Republicans and Democrats alike.
So I think that brings us to the title of your book, After the Apocalypse. I guess in order to describe what comes after, we have to describe, what do we mean by the apocalypse? Why are you using that term in particular?
I use the term because if you look at sort of the press, the vocabulary that the media began to use to describe the catastrophes that we, the nation, we were experiencing, particularly in the year 2020, the term apocalypse gets used over and over again. What was the apocalypse is the effects of climate change. You know, wildfires burning out of control. The fire season becoming longer. The apocalypse is a pandemic that's killed now, what, 600,000 of our fellow citizens and millions of people around the world. The apocalypse is the utter collapse of an economy that we imagined was, you know, solid, sturdy, and on a path of continued growth. The apocalypse was the presidency of Donald Trump, a source of this enormous antagonism and division, the way our country pitted, you know, people pitted against one another. And I think you can make an argument that an element of the apocalypse was the reckoning with racism. And I'm not, the reckoning with racism was necessary, but we have to be honest that the reckoning with racism then stokes this violent opposition by people who, whether they will admit it or not, want to preserve a social order in which, you know, whites enjoy an advantageous position. To others, all of this happening in the year 2020 made that year a period of enormous stress. And so the purpose of my book was to try to say, well, what spins out of this? What are the implications of this brief but very challenging period of time? And what are the implications in particular for America's role in the world? I mean, you can look at the events of 2020 from all kinds of angles. I was looking at it from the angle of, what does this mean for the role that we should play going forward?
I just wanted to add to that too. I think another aspect of this apocalypse, so to speak, and I wouldn't limit this to just 2020, but there's also, in addition to racism, climate change, we have, I think, a skyrocketing sort of divide in economic inequalities. And I think you even see that with, I'm in PA, I'm in Pennsylvania, and I go to some of the rural parts like Johnstown, who they voted for Donald Trump. And you ask them why, and they say, well, we don't think that Trump is going to help us, but, you know, we're a dead town and we don't really like Hillary. It was a protest vote. And I think that's another part of this. It's just, there's so much inequality.
I have to agree with you. There's no, I mean, this goes back to my explanation for why the foreign policy explanation for why people voted for Trump. A lot of it, I think, was a protest vote. A lot of it was a repudiation of establishment thinking. Establishment thinking on matters of economy embraced globalism, embraced neoliberal principles, embraced the idea of an open world where capital and goods would flow freely. And this is really going back to the Clinton administration. You know, the promise that opening the world up for commerce and investment was going to benefit everybody. Well, guess what? It did benefit some people. I mean, a lot of people have gotten very, very, very rich, to include people in China. But in within our own country, yeah, it's been communities that have been totally devastated. And these are people who think they have been lied to. And, you know, frankly, with some cause, they should believe them.
We have entire parts of the country, I think, that they've just stagnated economically. And there really hasn't been an answer given by either side of the political spectrum on how we deal with this or how we lift people out of this. And I wonder, in that sense, how does foreign policy tie into domestic policy? Because I think people try to separate the two, and I don't think you can get a lot done domestically if you don't address these foreign policy issues and how much money we spend on it.
Well, I agree with you. I agree in particular that there has long been this tendency to think that domestic policy and foreign policy fit in two separate buckets. That's simply not the case. I think that during the Cold War, you could make the case that national security policy helped to sustain economic prosperity. I mean, the military-industrial complex came to be in part because politicians persuaded themselves that funneling money to the Pentagon was one way to ensure that constituents back home had regular jobs. I would argue at the present moment that the foreign policies that have carried over from the Cold War, particularly the emphasis on maintaining and using military power, now get in the way of correcting our economic deficiencies. Let me give you a specific example from the book. You know, when President Biden went on his foreign policy trip, and he visited NATO headquarters in Brussels. And like every president, with the exception of Donald Trump, proclaimed the absolute importance of NATO as a cornerstone of U.S. national security policy. This despite the fact that the conditions that necessitated the creation of NATO back in 1949, none of those conditions exist anymore. But by God, he's committed to preserving NATO. I have to say that I've long believed that the European members of NATO are fully capable of providing for their own security. You know, if we look at the population of those countries in Europe compared to the population of Russia, if we look at the wealth of those countries compared to the wealth of Russia, they can handle it. Russia's got a lot of nukes. Europe has fewer nukes. I'm not sure if that matters. You know, what's the utility of nuclear weapons? Apart from deterrence, next to nothing. So in the book, I argue, rather than maintaining NATO, rather than declaring we have some kind of a special relationship with the United Kingdom, based on what? We would do well to pay more attention to our relations with our nearest neighbors, with Canada and Mexico. Mexico in particular, I think, sort of gets treated as an afterthought in the hierarchy of American interests. But in terms of our economic prosperity, our security, Canada and Mexico are vastly more important than anything, than any European country. I'm not saying Europe doesn't matter. I am saying it doesn't matter as much as Canada and Mexico. But that is not reflected in the blobs hierarchy of priorities. And I think that is evidence of the extent to which the blob is just, its mindset is just stuck in the past.
I was going to add to that. I think in some ways, these institutions that form the blob, it's almost like they've become, I don't know if fossilized is the right word, but I think it's not just the defense contractors giving money to think tanks. I think it's also you don't have this new blood always coming in to these institutions, and the institutions sort of stay in one mode of thought from the Cold War.
Yeah. So you're a young guy. If you said, gosh, I aspire to one day become the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for whatever. And it's time for you now to start, you know, proving yourself. It's time for you to demonstrate to other members of the establishment that you belong in their number. Well, how do you do that? Well, you do that by reciting the cliches, by saying, yes, NATO is crucially important. I believe in NATO. If, on the contrary, you said, I think NATO was utterly obsolete. I don't know why the hell we're bothered with that anymore. I got to tell you, you ain't going to get very far in the foreign policy establishment. So you're right. There is a mindset. And if you want to get very far, you need to embrace that mindset. If you want to go ahead and, you know, write op-eds for your local newspaper, then you can be as much of a critic as you want to. But, you know, unfortunately, that doesn't get you very far.
And I was going to say, it reminds me, I've had a few centrist friends in D.C. That I disagree with on foreign policy. But one thing that will always come up is Richard Nixon, right? And, you know, I think the way Richard Nixon dealt with China was actually, I think we had a breakthrough diplomatically with China. I talked to Ambassador Chaz Freeman about that because he was there for it. And whenever I bring that up, I've had certain centrist sort of friends say to me, well, oh, that was just appeasing China. It's almost as if there's this mindset of any kind of diplomacy is out of the question.
I'm with you on Nixon. I mean, obviously, he was not a particularly principled person and, you know, played fast and loose with the law. I'm glad he was forced out of office, forced to resign. But you're right. I mean, he had the vision, and it was vision, to recognize that at a moment we were bogged down in this misguided war in Vietnam that was justified by a notion of monolithic communism, he had the gumption to recognize that communism was not a monolith. Indeed, that far from being allies or partners, the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China were adversaries, and their adversarial relationship presented an opportunity to us, something we could exploit to our own advantage. So there was some brilliance there in the way he engineered the opening to China. Of course, now we are all these years later, and China is not today what it was then, and we've got a new problem set. But I think you're right. You know, we get stuck in these ruts. The establishment gets stuck in these ruts, and they don't welcome fresh ideas.
What do you think are the main things, what are the main lessons of the 20th century that maybe we haven't heeded to in the 21st century? I'm thinking about things like issues of blowback, the Pentagon Papers, which you just wrote about. What do you think are the main lessons that we haven't learned from?
Well, I think a big one relates to the nature of war. We have persuaded ourselves this is particularly the case in the post-Cold War era, we have persuaded ourselves that war is a useful instrument, that we can control war, that we can direct it, that we can get war to behave so that we can use force to achieve our purposes. That's a perspective that utterly rejects centuries of history, which say, which demonstrate that war is a chameleon. War is the is an arena of chance. You know, to go to war is to risk all. I think we still have not learned that. I wish we would. And if we did, we'd become far more cautious in our use of force. I think so. I think that's a big thing. I think also, and maybe we're coming around to, you know, that we are a country that has been infatuated with technology for a long time, and that today it's an infatuation with information technology, a belief that it has life transforming potential, and of course in some respects it certainly does, but I think we're only now beginning to realize that our love affair with technology. And I don't mean just, I mean, love affair with technology that goes back to the beginning of the industrial age has had massively negative effects on the planet, on the environment. And that unless we make fairly radical changes in the way we live, means rethinking patterns of consumption, rethinking the belief that our way of life is based on mobility, that I should be able to go wherever I want to go, whenever I want to go there. If we persist in our present patterns of life, I mean, the evidence is beginning to mount that we're creating our own existential threat.
The thing that always gets me is that people will say, are you really worried about current conflicts maybe with, say, China or Iran turning into a hot conflict? And I will say, yeah, I think any kind of unpredictable escalation that happens on, say, the South China Sea, you don't know what can happen. I don't think that countries, nation states, always make the most rational decisions. And for me, that's the big concern with the DC blob is, I think that no matter what we think, oh, war can't happen. A hot conflict can't happen. Yes, it can. There's always these unpredictable scenarios that arise.
True. You know, once upon a time, our consciousness of the origins of World War I was acute. I mean, an example of a runaway war that nobody really intended was something that the general population, I think, even understood. But even though we just recently passed the centennial of the beginning of, or the end of World War I, those old lessons, if we want to call them that, I think have faded away. Now, we have circumstances today, a lot of buzz about Taiwan and whether or not Taiwan could end up being a source of a shooting war into which the United States would be drawn. But I got to say, I don't think it's taken seriously enough. And also remembering that any shooting war involving the People's Republic of China and us would immediately carry with it the risk of the use of nuclear weapons. We've come to take for granted the existence of these nuclear arsenals. When I was a young man, I took for granted. When I was a young man, I had absolute confidence in the strategy of deterrence that had been devised, you know, beginning in the very late 1940s, but basically through the 1950s and into the 1960s. You know, thinking through scenarios and what posture would be most likely to deter the enemy, but also avert a nuclear exchange. I've come to believe that almost all of that was absolute nonsense, and certainly doesn't really do us much good when we're talking about the United States and China, or India and Pakistan, or Israel and whoever. It amazes me that right now, the United States is engaged in a something like a $1.5 trillion modernization of our nuclear strike force, initiated by Obama, continued by Trump, now continued under Biden, new strategic bombers, new ICBMs, new nuclear submarines, new warheads. Why are we doing this? Why isn't it a matter of discussion and debate? Why isn't there a pro-peace party that challenges the necessity of this modernization program? It's just happening. It doesn't even get discussed. And I think, in a sense, that is an example of how our inattention to important security matters can set us up for that scenario that can suddenly find us at the brink of war involving nuclear weapons. And who the hell's thinking about it? I mean, I don't get a sense that maybe behind closed doors, there's a lot of serious people doing serious thinking, but I'm not persuaded.
There's just two more things I wanted to briefly cover, and then we'll wrap up because I know we're coming against the hour. The first, I just wanted to mention this briefly and get your thoughts on it. You know, since I mentioned Robert Kagan earlier, one of the things that sort of upsets me when I read a piece like that Robert Kagan piece is I feel like it's not the Robert Kagans that are going off to fight these wars. It's friends that I have in places like Greenville, PA. And now a lot of these kids in places like Greenville, PA, they don't want to be fighting these wars. They think, you know, what did I do this for? And I think that is, you know, a very real concern for them. I don't think it's necessarily Robert Kagan fighting the wars. It's kids that, you know, think that it's a way out of, you know, their town or their economic situation. And I think they just have very different circumstances than a lot of the people pushing for more wars.
No doubt about it. And you were coming back around to yet another explanation for why Trump got elected. You know, that the people who do go fight, you know, the people who went to Iraq in 2003, being told this was going to be a great victory resulting in the spread of democracy and we would be beloved, found out that that was all false. Whether conscious lies were told or not, certainly the war was not what it was sold as. And, I mean, there are a handful of people from Harvard, Princeton, and Yale that sign up, but it's a relative handful. And it gets us off on a completely different topic, but I don't want to go down that trail. But we have a military system, meaning the system whereby we create, fill, sustain the armed forces. The system we have created is not democratic. It's not effective. And nobody wants to talk about it. Because when you talk about it, then people say, oh, you must be in favor of the draft. I'm not in favor of the draft. But I got to tell you, I'm not in favor of the so-called all-volunteer force, which sends the kind of young people you are referring to off to fight these endless wars, and then all too often brings them back to us damaged, the damage that they sustain for the rest of their lives.
So in closing, I think we have all these national security issues here at home, domestically, climate change, racism, economic inequality, even, you know, since we were talking about the rise of sort of Trump and Trumpism, if people are concerned about, you know, say what happened on January 6th, then maybe we should be concerned about why those people thought the way they did it. Maybe foreign policy plays a role in that, right? The right. Rise of Trumpism. Right. So what can we do to sort of create and foster a new approach to national security, or how can we redirect national security into these domestic issues?
Well, that's a $64 question. I don't have a good answer. I mean, what we can do is what you do. I mean, there is a massive need for re-education. Re-educating citizens about what national security ought to mean, but re-educating us as to what actually threatens us. And you would think, well, that shouldn't be too difficult, given that we've just had 600,000 Americans die of a pandemic. But I think it is difficult because we are so much in the habit of thinking that the essence of U.S. national security policy is to keep giving money to the Pentagon, maintaining overseas bases, and fighting wars. We're sort of caught in this cycle. But what you do, I think, can help make a difference.
I just wanted to add one thing to that. In some ways, I think the greatest threat we face in some ways is, I think culturally, we're threatened by anything that is seen as an attack on our sort of exceptionalist identity. We're America, manifest destiny. We're the best. Right. So, you know, we can get people in Iraq or Afghanistan to sort of agree with our way of life. And you can't really force other countries to do what you want all the time. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe we have to reevaluate our sort of exceptionalist mythology.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you're raising this topic. We could now spend another hour talking about the origins of American exceptionalism and the problem posed by American exceptionalism. But it does get to the essence of things. Our own sense of who we are and where we fit. If we don't change that, then this conviction, this belief in American global hegemony will be very difficult to dislodge.
Well, I want to thank you, Andrew Bacevich, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners pick up After the Apocalypse? And also, how can they keep up with the Quincy Institute?
Well, I mean, the book should be in your local bookstores. I hate to say it, but you can buy it on Amazon, since I want to be one of these people that's trying to make Bezos even richer than he already is. Quincy Institute's got a website, of course. We've got a blog called Responsible Statecraft. The blog publishes 2, 3, 4 pieces a day that offer our critique of U.S. foreign policy, that explain alternative policies based on the principle of restraint. So, you know, take a look at my book, but, you know, probably more important, take a look at Responsible Statecraft, which you can find easily online.
Thank you again, Andrew Bacevich, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Andrew Bacevich of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and the author of the new book, After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. I have to say, I was very, very proud of this conversation. I hold Andrew Bacevich in the highest regard. I think he is a very important thinker and commentator on U.S. foreign policy today, and it was an honor to speak with him, and I hope that you found the conversation as enlightening as I did. It was a very proud moment for me when it comes to this program. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey.
If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.